but I wouldn't feel that I have a moral right to do physical harm to them or call for others to do physical harm to them, to cage them and beat them and pull guns on them. So that's the nature of freedom. I think people need to think about those kind of things a little bit more often.
Hello, welcome to episode 16 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I was excited to meet Bruce Fenton at the recent Texas Bitcoin Conference. He was quite friendly and fun to speak with, and I believe our conversation gives a good sense of who Bruce is as a person. Please note that we spoke before Bruce was voted in by the Bitcoin Foundation Board as their new executive director, so we do not speak about that. I also spoke with Scott Rose, who I was familiar with from his comedic Bitcoin videos. Scott's background as an actor and as a hired speaker for Apple, combined with his passion for Bitcoin, makes him a great cryptocurrency proponent. I always try to provide links to just about everything discussed in these podcasts, so just look in the show notes for this episode on letstalkbitcoin.com if you want to follow up on anything we talked about. I've also created a bit.ly link for this episode's page. Just go to bit.ly/TBG16 for The Bitcoin Game, episode 16. Here's Bruce.
I'm excited to be standing here with Bruce Fenton. So what is the Bitcoin Association?
It's an industry group that's focused on education and advocacy for people, businesses, governments, and charitable groups to educate them about Bitcoin and related technologies. And it started, originally, there was a group of a few of us that were very unhappy with the original BitLicense proposal. So we wanted to write a letter, and we wanted to do it in some kind of standing other than just a bunch of guys writing a letter. So we created this association, and that actually kind of took off, that we ended up with, especially right after we wrote the letter, we ended up with hundreds of people signing it. We had about 400 or 500 signatures. We put the letter online, and then that grew to more. I think it was probably over 1,000 by the time the comment policy was, or comment period was done. And then we kind of grew from there. People went to the website, and we ended up with several hundred members that joined, and that's basically how it started.
Okay. And I guess it was controversial, but it all seems to be diffused now. The Satoshi Roundtable that I guess was you were behind.
I'm the organizer of it. Yeah, I guess the Satoshi Roundtable is a private gathering of people in Bitcoin who are leaders in some way, of about 50 people, and we met on a private island and in around February, and it was, I guess there was, I don't know really if there was that much controversy. It was kind of talk about controversy, but I haven't really yet to meet anyone who was actually upset or mad or worried. There was a few people who kind of had a question, like, what are you doing? And there was some people who were kind of buzzing about saying, well, isn't this just like the banks, or isn't this some kind of effort to co-opt or control Bitcoin? But to me, I think that really shows somewhat of a lack of understanding about how Bitcoin works. For one thing, there's nothing that any group can really do that could change the code in a way that's going to hurt everybody else unless the majority of miners agree. And the other thing is, if you look at the type of people that were at the event, this would not be typically the type of people you'd be worried about some kind of conspiracy that are going to want to hurt or control people. I mean, we joked at the roundtable. I said, it's the group where everybody gets together to secretly figure out how to take over the world and then leave everybody alone. Because that's really, it's very much a group of people that were certainly liberty leading and a lot of anarchists, and not a group that has the kind of ill will or anything out. As some ulterior motive. So, it was a success. It was fun. I think people like getting together, and it's nice to get. There is something to be said for privacy, and just like you and I can have a private conversation after this interview, we can go and talk, and that's something that we should expect to not be public, and we should have that right if somebody else wants to listen in. That we should only allow that if we agree to it, and there's a benefit to that, and I think most people agree to that. That if a friend of mine from here, Anthony, who came to the roundtable, and I want to go and grab a conversation, that we would have that right to do that in private. So what is the difference if you have 10 people or 20 people? At what point do other people have the right to someone else's private communications? I say never, unless the people in those communications agree to it.
Did you have some specific goals when you decided to do this?
Yeah, my goal was pretty simple. I wanted to do something that was fun and hang out with people that I really like and something cool that was away from the sort of noise that you get with your typical conference, where it's kind of loud and there's a lot of different people and there's newcomers and oldcomers and there's people looking for jobs and pitches, and it gets kind of a lot of buzz, which is great. And I love the conference scene, but it's nice to be a little bit quieter, where it's just a smaller group of peers, where you can just talk to people who you know, who they're not necessarily pitching you, or they're basically a gathering of pretty much equals, very similar people, a lot of early adopters, a lot of CEOs, a lot of people who are investors in the space, kind of talk privately. So my motivation was simple. I just wanted to hang out and have make more connections and have fun with people who are my friends.
So I was wrong. I guess I would have thought maybe you had a couple of concerns you wanted to kind of address with people who are really, or, you know, what if just to kind of talk about some specific subjects, maybe.
No, I didn't really at all as far as subject matter. A couple of the attendees had a few things. There was miners that wanted to talk about concerns with the ability to cover transactions because the revenue from transactions is kind of small. There was a couple other people who kind of wanted to talk about their specific ideas for technology or something like that. But now, me personally, I didn't have any content goals at all. I just wanted to really have good quality people hang out. And most of the people it ranged from people who are very good friends with, pretty good friends with, and then some people I didn't really know at all. So it was kind of a nice mix. And that's the way it was for most attendees. Most people had a good handful of really great friends and a good handful of people they know, and then a good handful of people that they didn't know. So it was sort of the perfect size for that, where you kind of maybe have 10 people you know really well, 10 people you never met before, but you know who they are.
It seemed pretty neat. I was really excited because my neighborhood crypto startup is Gem, and so when Micah told me he was there, I was like, you were there? I was
cool.
Pretty excited about that. And
yeah.
So when did you first get into Bitcoin?
So I consider myself late, but I was saying that to somebody the other day, and they said I was really early. It was 2013. I first bought Bitcoin and really got involved, so somewhat late.
And how did it get on your radar at that time?
I think it was because I have a large Facebook page. I have almost 100,000 people on my Facebook, and a lot of those people are very liberty-leaning, a lot of New Hampshire Free State people, that kind of thing, and they were talking about Bitcoin. I had people, they were selling guns for Bitcoin, and I said, what is this crazy Bitcoin thing? And then I saw the price kept going up, and so I bought it first as speculation. I didn't really even think about it that much. And then it went up a lot more. And then I started paying more attention. I said, wow, why is this going up? What is happening? And then I went, probably one of the big turning points was the first conference that I went to. I didn't make it to that San Jose conference, but I did go to probably maybe the second conference, the Bitcoin conference, which was the first Vegas one.
Oh, okay.
And that really changed my view. That was the first time I saw Andreas speak in person, the first time I saw a lot of these people I had heard about, and that was a big turning point where I said, wow, this is... And so ever since then, I've been totally immersed in getting more and more into it.
So the only depressing thing about interviewing people is, you know, when I got into Bitcoin at the same time or before other people and seeing all their achievements, I was like, wow, you guys have done a lot. People have, you know, started big companies and stuff and found out about Bitcoin after I did. So.
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, it's amazing. There's some miners that came in after me that have made fortunes, and there's people that have had really quick exits. You know, Vinny from Gift had basically an 18-month start to finish to his exit on a $50 million company. So there's been some really great success stories of people who've moved fast. It's a fast-moving space. Things change. I've been to conferences. I've met people who have they're kind of unformed startups, a couple friends with a totally unformed idea, and they're kind of thinking about doing a startup. I'll meet them at a conference again 4 or 5 months later, and they've already gotten funding. They've already gotten 15, 20 employees. They've got a solid plan. It's really amazing how things move so fast.
And that's what's been fun, being in L.A. I see the big Airbits, seeing Paul at
yep.
the shows and Micah too, and they talk about their projects, and I just go, oh, that's interesting, and next thing you know, they're like, you know, ruling the world with their projects, or
yeah,
they're
great.
At least funded and have a bunch going on. So
yeah,
it's really
exciting. It's great to see. I remember when BitPay was doing their first seed round and Coinbase was not far ahead, and there really wasn't anybody else that serious in the space. This is just probably around the first Miami conference, which was a year and a half ago. And, you know, remember, Circle is pretty new. And look at what they've done. The Circle's amazing, I think.
So now Circle, I feel like they were so much in the news when they launched, and it seems like things have been quiet. I feel like they must be about ready to make some more waves and do something.
Well, yeah, I just had coffee with Jeremy Laird like a week ago, and I should have been embarrassed because I hadn't seen his latest app. I had seen his app about a month or two before. He said, "Hey, have you seen the latest app?" And I said, I think so. I don't know. And he showed me. I hadn't really seen it. He had done all kinds of advancements. So the wallet app is incredible now. It's really, really good. For what it is, it's the best wallet. There are other wallets that are independent of the identity verification and other things that Circle requires, so it's sort of a little bit different competition. But as far as ease of use and bells and whistles, you can actually take out your credit card, put it in front of the camera of your iPhone, and that credit card will be used to buy Bitcoin instantly. So you don't even have to put in your credit card numbers. You just show it your credit card and say, "I want $80 worth of Bitcoin," and bang, instantly you have it. No verification process beyond that, no waiting. You have it, you can send it. So there's a lot of neat bells and whistles like that, ability to send out of your contact list, things like that. So I think, from what he was saying, I think that they will probably market more heavily later now that they've worked so much on the technology. The technology is very, very good for what they're trying to do. I think it's excellent. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if they do a bigger push where they're more of a consumer push now that they seem to have their tech down quite well.
Yeah, we'll see. I have a media request. They're supposedly trying to schedule something for me mid-April, so maybe they have something coming. I don't know. So what do you do mostly nowadays?
So I've been working on kind of transitioning out of a lot of the old business that I used to do. I started in the investment business 20 years ago, and over years gravitated more towards big picture economic consulting, where I served a smaller number of really huge clients. So I have clients that are very, very, very wealthy, billionaire, deca-billionaire type of individuals, and large charitable organizations and private equity firm and things like that. So as I've become more and more immersed in the Bitcoin space, I've been sort of cutting down on that old kind of business and trying to replace it with more Bitcoin type of stuff. So I have a few different things that I'm looking at. I'm definitely going to be full-time Bitcoin within this year. And there's a few different ways that I'm looking at doing that hopefully I'll be able to get into more detail in the next couple months.
So, I mean, sounds like you're a pretty big deal when it comes to just what you're doing before Bitcoin. People with that much money would come to you specifically for what type of advice?
So I started this investment firm called, I used to be at Morgan Stanley, and then I started an investment firm called Atlantic Financial, which was the first full service firm to use the internet back in 1994. And we served regular retail clients. I had thousands of clients who were your regular dentists, doctors, people with $500,000, $1 million type of people. And then over time, we, like many advisors, we wanted to serve larger and larger clients. It's not always the greatest business idea, but it's kind of what every financial advisor wants to do. They want to serve the richer people, the people with 10 million, 20 million, 100 million, billion. And through different luck, marketing, connections, whatever, we ended up with a few of those clients and then a few more and grew a larger base. And then we ended up less able to serve the smaller clients, so we kind of consolidated, ended up with a lot less clients. We went from probably 5,000 clients to 5 clients, but the 5 clients had way, way more assets than all of the other people.
You were a money manager, basically?
Yeah, money manager. Now, the thing that was interesting, as our clients became larger, your typical model when you're a regular retail broker is you charge a percent or two of assets. So if somebody has $1 million, you charge them a percent, you manage their money. Well, when somebody has $10 or $20 billion, that doesn't work anymore. I wish it did. I'd probably have a few percent of Bitcoin right now if that was the case. But when you get to, at least for our model, when we get to the really, really large clients, where we have clients with $50-60 billion kind of range, we don't charge a percent anymore. You don't even charge a fraction of a percent. It's usually for us on a flat fee base. And the advice tended to be much more both broad and specific at the same time. So it was not as much about saying, "Hey, you should buy or sell this stock." They have whole teams of people to do that. Or even you should work with this money manager or that money manager. But it was more things like, okay, we're looking at expanding into this region. We want connections there. I did a lot of stuff in the Middle East, so making connections in the Middle East, working with deals there, introducing people, that kind of thing.
Were there specific sectors or things you had interest in that...
Mostly emerging markets and emerging technology, which is what brought me to Bitcoin, same as it brought me to the internet. Anything that's new and emerging, I've always had a belief that the information in the world is inefficient, and you have to kind of dig. You have to dig on the internet or dig on podcasts like yours to find good information that is not in the mainstream. So I was in Dubai, investing in Dubai, right after 9/11, when everybody was terrified of all Arabs and terrified of the Middle East, and they thought that Dubai was some kind of war zone controlled by the Taliban. And really what it was the groundwork for what is now one of the greatest cities in the world in 15 years.
So I assume that was a good buying opportunity at that point.
It was a great buying opportunity. And also, when you're immersed in a space like that, hopefully, I had it happen with the internet and I had it happen with Dubai, hopefully you can recognize when things are overhyped. So I was lucky to get out of Dubai before they had a big real estate crash. So I did well in the Dubai investment, and then I kind of diversified. That made me a lot of connections in the Middle East with Saudi Arabia and other countries there, and got to know more people, and then that helped me serve the clients that I have in the United States. And my clients are Americans typically.
Well, it is just amazing to me that there's so many smart people, financial, technical, who are so drawn to Bitcoin. I mean, I don't know what I'm good at, but it makes me feel like I'm in good company.
Well, thanks for including me on that list. There's a lot of people that I feel the same way about. I'm flattered to be included, but I figure that there's a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me. There's some really bright names in this space, and it's great to see, like I mentioned, when you're looking at something like BitPay raising their seed round, it was just a tiny amount of time ago. And at that time, there wasn't very many quality teams like that looking to raise money or in operation. Now you see all kinds of companies. You see BitGo, which has Will O'Brien and Ben Davenport, who was a really high-ranking guy at Facebook. You have some really serious people in this space now. I mean, Jeremy Allaire has already run publicly traded companies. He is becoming less the anomaly. There's more people like him that are entering this space who are really serious and really accomplished people in finance, in tech, in development, and that's great. It's really great to see.
I just think it's so fun when I interview people here or whatever, when I find out about a new company, I find out the technical person behind it, his background. I'm just like, oh my God, you just sound like a real technical genius. You've been, you know, doing this really high-level work for 10 years, and now you want to get into Bitcoin.
And just seeing what things can do, like Shapeshift. I was one of the lucky few that Eric told he was running it beforehand, and which makes it hard for me. I have a few secrets rolling around in my head, and it's always hard to keep a secret because I don't want to accidentally say something. But it was really cool. When he first demoed it, I said, wow, that's just plain neat. It's just neat. You can use something and do it. And with Shapeshift, if people don't know, you can take and put one type of coin and chain it to another kind of altcoin without any sort of account. You just put in a Litecoin address and a Bitcoin address, bang, exchange. And that's amazing. It's amazing tech that didn't exist just a couple months ago, and now look at it. It's really cool.
I agree. I was just so surprised when I finally went to the website and it's this easy? You just send money to an address, put another address, and...
I just used it the other day because Darkcoin changed their name to Dashcoin, and I thought that was a good marketing move because whether you like Dark Wallet or not, it's confusing to some people, and some people don't. I like Dark Wallet. I think it's great, but it confuses some people, and some people it turns them off. So from a marketing standpoint, it makes perfect sense for Darkcoin, who has no affiliation with Dark Wallet, to change their name to Dashcoin. I said, well, that's smart. I want to get a couple of Dashcoin or Darkcoin. And I went on, and they didn't have them available in one account that I used. And I was going to look at another account. I said, wait a minute, I forgot. How about Shapeshift? So I whipped out my phone, and it was instant. I did it right before a flight. I only had like 10 minutes. I was able to do it. You never could open an account that fast.
So you had a wallet ready to send to? Or?
I went and Googled how to do a wallet, and I have a security thing that I do to make sure that when I generate addresses, they're done. So I did that, and that was it. But that was already set up because I do it for Bitcoin all the time. So that it only took me a minute.
And I've got to admit, that's been the hard part for me. Like I still owe, you know, at one point I said, oh, I got to try to buy a bunch of alts, and they're still sitting on exchanges because I haven't taken the time to figure out, well, how do I generate all these wallets and do it securely? And
right. Yeah. Keeping them on exchanges is a great method in some ways. I mean, that's
I
one thing.
You're gonna say the opposite.
Yeah, no, that is one method that you can do on Shapeshift. It's one extra step that you have, but it's not so bad. It's no harder. You should have, people in general should have a system for easy creation of wallets. What I think it's really simple. A lot of people use Ubuntu and emulators and all these different kinds of complex technical solutions. I didn't want to mess with all that. I would think every techie has a junk laptop sitting around their house. I mean, everybody in this space, if you're anything like me, I have a dozen junk computers sitting around my house. You know, I always have computer parts and equipment and everything. So I just took an old junk laptop, and even if you don't have one, you can buy one for $100-$200. Just get an old piece of junk laptop and never connect it to the internet again. And that's what I did. So if you want to generate a wallet, you can if you have a clean USB stick that you trust, you can take it from one computer, put it on the junk laptop, and technically you could, something could get in. I mean, it would be very hard to compromise that. And if you really want to be secure, you could just make sure everything is loaded on at one point, and then, you know, have all your different ways to generate wallets, and then leave it alone, never go on the internet again.
Yeah, I once started with the Ubuntu CD and printed like 100 Bitcoin wallets, and I still have a bunch of them so I have them ready. And that was over a year ago.
I love paper wallets. I use Bitaddress and Bitcoin paper wallet. I print these things a lot. I have a bunch right in my bag, and I use them quite a bit. I use them when I travel, and you print a few copies. You can keep them in a secure location, and if they're BIP38 protected, which is the password protection using the BIP38 protocol, then it's very secure. You can give it to a friend, and you don't really need to even trust that. All you have to trust that friend is that your friend is not so bad that they're going to do a brute force attack on your wallet.
Sure.
You could rip it in half and give half to two different people. There's a lot of different things you can do to protect that, and you don't have to worry about it that much. So I like
that
a lot.
Do you just remember the passphrase, or do you have that written down somewhere else? Or maybe you don't want to tell me what you do?
There are ways. What I can tell you is there are ways to, if you Google different ways to generate passwords and memorize passwords, there's different best practices you can do that can be derivative on different kinds of things, like names of a animal or something like that, colors, different things like that, that can help you generate bulk passwords that are memorizable, or you can use the same password. There's a few different ways to do it, but if that password is pretty secure, and you, even if you use the same one, you're in pretty good shape. But you can there's even ways you can have it be tied to the wallet in some ways that are very, very hard to figure out.
I guess I worry too, if it's just in your head and something happens to you, then
what? Oh, I totally, yeah. You want to have a backup plan, and I have a plan backed up that, because I have money in cold storage that's in Bitcoin, and absolutely I have a plan for that where that is retrievable by somebody if I die. You don't want to have your Bitcoins die with you. And I know a few people that are in this space, they're single or whatever, they don't really think about that. And I think it's kind of a shame to have, though, if something were to happen to them, accidents do happen, you wouldn't want to have the coins die. And it's nice to have that backup. There's other things that can happen to you too. You could be a victim of an accident, trauma, like a 9/11 scale attack could happen at your office building and you're one of the only survivors. I mean, there's any number of different crazy things that could happen. Getting hit, you lose a limb, something like that.
Okay, you're making me scared.
Well, those are all of the kind of things, those are exactly the kind of things that cause the mental trauma that would make somebody forget their password. Loss of a loved one, something like that. That's exactly when you may need the Bitcoin. So other than death, there's many things that you could be subject to losing that password. So you want to make sure that somebody else has it and there's a way to retrieve it if it's needed by a loved one or family or something like that.
So back to Shapeshift, you just, on a old laptop, you installed the different wallet software for the different coins?
Yeah, you can do it. It's basically a web page. It's the same as Bitaddress. So you can just put that on there and generate it. And it's pretty secure. It's not, I didn't look into it. I don't know Darkcoin that well. I don't know if there's a kind of a BIP38 type of thing. I would imagine there is. I don't really know how to do it. But it's not a ton of money, and it's a redundant system. As long as somebody doesn't grab that piece of paper, you're in pretty good shape. And you can have backups and things like that.
So you printed paper wallets off of there.
Yeah. or you can save them onto a USB or something like that and keep it in multiple locations.
I always even worry about, like, I have a laser printer that seems like it has memory and could be hacked, and I guess I get so paranoid.
Well, the more you have, I mean, this was a small amount, so I wasn't super worried about it. If you're an exchange or you are an early adopter, you know, one of these lucky people who mined back in 2011 and you have 15,000 coins, the more you have and the more you think you may be a target. Also, if you're known and people know you have these coins, then the more careful you have to be. And there's other things that you can do. And for more serious coins, I'm even more careful. I might not even use that laptop. I might have a dedicated one and use BIP38. And, you know, you have redundant kind of systems where you have to think, like, what are the steps somebody needs to do to steal this? And if it's like, you know, five different steps, okay, you have a multi-signal wallet, they're going to have to kidnap two or three people, and they have to crack into a bank, and they have to catch the BIP38. You get to a point where it's like, okay, yeah, that's theoretically possible, but it's going to be easier for them to just do a heist of something, and you don't have to worry about it that much.
So are you an investor in many Bitcoin companies?
Just a couple. ChangeTip and a couple others. And it's not so much my model to be set up for it. I'd like to do it as an individual angel, but if there's something I really believe in and like, and I'd like to do maybe a little bit more, but I don't really have a fund with my investment firm. A lot of people figure that because we're an investment company, we must have a fund that's well suited for this. We're not a venture capital firm, but I really like that area, and I'm moving more towards that. I'm talking to some different people that I work with and like in the space who are more into venture capital about ways we can kind of partner together and moving more towards that area.
Tippercoin seems like it's doing really well. Oh, no, I mean, sorry, ChangeTip. Before that was Tippercoin. I think there was even another one before that I had used. Why is ChangeTip kind of taken over, you think?
Well, ChangeTip has a great team, and they have great investors. Pantera is the lead investor, and there's some other really good investors. They've got a great CEO. They've got a good focus. You know, Nick, the CEO, will say that he believes in focus on what he's doing. He doesn't try. There's too many people in this space that try and do too many different things. There's a million different opportunities, but you're really better off trying to do a couple things really well. So those are some of the reasons that I like it. One thing I really like about ChangeTip is that it is sort of independent of the rest of the technology, even independent of Bitcoin. It's just an idea that uses Bitcoin. It wouldn't really be possible without Bitcoin. You couldn't do it with Visa. But it's a great idea in itself, and it's fun. I actually like tipping, and I like giving and receiving tips. It's kind of fun. It's like their slogan says, the love button for the internet. It's cool, and I think it's got a lot of potential. And it's also good for Bitcoin, because when non-Bitcoiners get tips, especially if it's more than a dollar or two or three or especially five, they're really, really likely to cash that in. Even if they've never heard of Bitcoin before, never heard of ChangeTip before, and then they often the reaction is, wow, this is real money? Wow, that's really neat. How did you do that? So it's kind of cool.
How does the average, you think, new user who gets tipped in Bitcoin, how would they cash out, you think?
They may not necessarily cash out. A lot of people just tip it on to others, right, or they donate it to charity, or they could spend it. But yeah, you could cash it out. You could cash it out using Circle or Coinbase or something like that.
You're obviously doing a lot of Bitcoin transactions. How did you or are you doing your taxes this year to account for Bitcoin gains or losses?
I've got a pretty good tax person, so hopefully that will be not too much of a hassle. But yeah, it is a bit of a hassle to figure out what all these transactions are. I think that if you are, especially somebody like me who's kind of known to be involved in Bitcoin, you've got to, unfortunately, err on the side of caution and kind of maybe almost overdo it to make sure that you haven't missed anything. So kind of when in doubt, declare it. And if you break things down, just sort of assume, okay, here's this money that I took, and I'm going to assume every single bit of it is taxable kind of thing. Declare it all. That's better than trying to nickel and dime around things. And, you know, you'd be better off, rather than risk missing a coffee, go ahead and you know, be liberal in your prepare. I wish we didn't have to pay taxes at all, but it's a reality that we have to deal with, and you could get in big trouble. So you really probably want to overdo your caution in preparing these things and paying it.
The one thing I've been putting off, I've done almost all that accounting myself, but being active on the Counterparty platform as part of Let's Talk Bitcoin and having all kinds of transactions, both the Counterparty coins and then the tiny amounts of Bitcoin to power those transactions. Sometimes I just look at it and I'm like, I don't know what to do. I interviewed Jake Benson, who's, I guess, the CEO of LibreTax, and, like, they offer a kind of an aggressive, I guess you could say it's an aggressive, but it's not, it hasn't really been ruled on yet, I guess, where he'll go and match up the most tax advantageous buys and sells to give you the best results for each year, though other people are more like, well, first in, first out is yep. probably the way to go. You have any idea which way you're going to want your accountant to do it?
I'm not sure. I think that, there are definitely some ways you can match things up that are better, but I just despise taxes so much that I try to stay away from doing them as much as possible. I just hire somebody, and it's painful enough for me to go in there and sign where they say to sign, and I try not to get into the details.
Sure. And I guess it's really the accounting that's the hard part, the actual tax part at the end, I guess.
Yeah. And explaining to the accountant if they don't know about it already. It's a real hassle, and it's not my favorite thing to do, especially as a financial person. Sometimes people assume that I must be good at taxes or like it or something, but no, I just don't like the idea behind taxes so badly. I think that the money is being wasted in such a bad way, and it's so coercive and violent against us and involuntary that really bothers me enough. And then on top of that, to have this massive bureaucracy and all this ridiculous paperwork and everything, that's even more frustrating. So, yeah, one year my accountant actually banned me from her office. She said, you know what? Why don't you go downstairs and have a coffee at Starbucks and just chill for a little while and then come back in an hour and you can sign something? Because I was just so frustrated. I'm just not a fan of it at all. And I complain about every single painstaking detail. So that was probably, I don't know, several years ago. What I've learned since then is I just kind of, it's not worth the stress. I just sort of let them do it, and I pay. And I probably get taken to the cleaners a bit on the amount that I pay, but I'd rather just have it out of my mind and not deal with it. Pay an accountant. Hopefully they're going to get every benefit you can, but the details of it are not my favorite thing at all. Yeah.
So you identify yourself as a libertarian, I assume?
Yeah, usually libertarian. I don't usually use anarchist too much because I think it's among non-anarchists has misunderstood connotations. Even libertarian does. I'd rather just speak to people about ideas, because even if you say anarchist and people aren't already anarchists or haven't already gone through this process, they're just going to think you're a crazy person.
Yeah. Well, I gotta admit, I was shocked when I first got into Bitcoin, and I guess I was getting into it right around when Let's Talk Bitcoin was starting, and hearing Stephanie talk about being an anarchist, I was like, well, you don't sound like what I would think an anarchist would sound like.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's that film, that fiction film that came out the day of anarchy, and it's basically a bunch of complete and total raging psychopaths who say, okay, if we had a day of anarchy, we would just randomly kill everybody, and it's total violence and chaos, and it's just total nonsense. That's what the general public thinks of as anarchy. So why waste time and energy having that argument? Even libertarianism, if you say libertarianism, a lot of people in mainstream are going to immediately associate that with racism or with any other negative, boneheaded misconceptions. So why even waste your time dealing with a label that doesn't serve you, that isn't productive? So among libertarians and anarchists, yeah, I'll identify myself that way. But with the general public, I really try not to, because I'd much rather focus on ideas. I say I am a pro-peace, anti-war person who doesn't like corporatism. And then it's funny, because most people, if you talk about the ideas, you're going to be accused of being a raving liberal by some, you're going to be accused of being a right-wing nut by others, and I get accused of the same thing in both days, or in the same day. And so, yeah, it's key to really focus on ideas, because a lot of liberals, a lot of people who identify themselves as liberals or progressives, really agree with a lot of the principles of libertarianism. They agree with, they don't like war, they don't like the police state, they don't like the drug war, they don't like the government telling people who they should marry or who they shouldn't marry. Yet they support those exact policies. They support people like Hillary Clinton, who are absolutely just as hawkish as Dick Cheney. And they support this heavy state involvement in our lives that leads to the violence. And they support this big government that has, you know, who do you think pays the police that are bashing people's heads on Occupy? You know, who do you think paid for these cops to go down there? The cops that were macing old women on the Occupy movement are directly and absolutely there because of a heavy pro-state push by well-meaning do-gooders who think that that's a solution. And same goes on the other side, not to just pick on the self-identified liberals and progressives, the same goes for the so-called conservatives who talk about small government, yet they support people who want government in our bedrooms and government in our wallets and this massive military-industrial complex fighting boogeymen all over the world who never really exist in some cases and certainly don't pose any threat to us in other cases. And they haven't really thought about these issues. So, yeah, I try and talk about the issues and the ideas as much as possible. And maybe my goal is always to win people over and get them to think. And labels sometimes stop them from doing that.
Sure. And as I was saying to Robert Murphy, I basically have grown up with very, you know, L.A., very liberal. And, I mean, I'd never even thought about the coercive taxes, laws, everything. I did just never kind of thought about it that way. So Bitcoin has kind of been an awakening for me just to understand a lot of these principles that I'd never even considered. So it's been an interesting, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people just haven't thought about it. If you ask people very simple questions about, is taxation violent? And if they say no, then you say, well, how do you collect them without violence? How? Show me how. Well, you just ask. Well, then what? What if you rip up the paper? What if you don't answer the door? Eventually, people are going to come to your house and put you in a cage or shoot you dead. That is violence, pure and simple. It is pure violence, and people don't realize that. All of these things, these well-meaning do-gooders, these people who go and call for more government. Right now, we see it. All these people up in arms about Indiana because they're saying that people should be free to discriminate. Very few people are saying, wait a minute, shouldn't you be free to discriminate? Shouldn't you have freedom to say what you want? Shouldn't you have freedom to be a jerk if you want? Shouldn't you be free to be a bigot if you want? Because the alternative is that you have the very, very same people who are all up in arms about Indiana and the governor signing this law are the same people who are all bent out of shape about the violent, coercive, militarized police. They don't understand, why do we have so many police who are beating people and shooting people based on race? Why do we have that? We have that because of you. We have that because of you people asking for more government, because of people asking for government to come in to a private business and tell them who they have to serve. And it goes both ways. There was a couple in Colorado who wanted to have anti-gay slurs put on a cake, and the cake baker didn't want to do it. Well, guess what? The law said you have to. And now the law says you have to serve the KKK, and you have to serve the skinheads, and you have to serve the neo-Nazis, and you have to serve people that you may not want to serve. And that doesn't make any sense to me. To me, everyone should be free, and if they're a jerk, if all of this effort, look at the huge backlash, look at the huge amount of response on Facebook. You're talking about fighting against boogeymen that aren't really there. Where is the big problem with discrimination? Their problem is with a law that allows discrimination. All of that effort, if you actually had real discrimination, if you had the Holiday Inn or the W or Coca-Cola or somebody who said, oh, great, now we finally have this law in Indiana that allows us to discriminate. Finally, we can ban those people. That's not going to happen. It just doesn't happen. And if it did, all of this huge amount of effort, these millions of people on Facebook who have been out of shape about it, could boycott that company, boycott the actual action. That's what freedom is. That's what you're supposed to do when you have a free society and free systems. People should be free to associate with who they want, and they should be free to have boycotts against those people. You don't need coercive, jackbooted thugs with nightsticks to make the world a better place. And guess what? It's not going to work anyway. You're not going to beat somebody into not being a bigot. You're not going to beat them into not being anti-gay or racist. You need to allow the freedom for people to do that. And people who are well-meaning, I understand. There are a lot of people that I like and respect. People I like and respect who, they're just not thinking it through with this law. And you see that again and again, where people just misunderstand the nature of freedom and what it is. They don't understand that there are drawbacks of freedom, but the alternative is state violence and coercion. And I would say, what level of violence is appropriate? If I don't want to serve KKK members at my business, what level of violence are you morally entitled to force me to serve them? Do you beat me? Do you cage me? Would you do it yourself? Because I don't want to serve KKK members. And if somebody doesn't want to serve someone based on race or religion, that's horrible. And I would boycott that store. But I wouldn't feel that I have a moral right to do physical harm to them or call for others to do physical harm to them, to cage them and beat them and pull guns on them. So that's the nature of freedom. I think people need to think about those kind of things a little bit more often.
Thanks, Bruce.
All right. Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Today's magic word is Bitcoiners. Bitcoiners. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's listener distribution of LTB coin on letstalkbitcoin.com.
What is the suey Bitcoin?
Today's sponsor is Bitcoin Keychains by bkeychain.com. You've seen these keychains on dozens and dozens of websites. It's about time you had one of your own. These substantial metal keychains make great conversation starters, and they make great gifts to or from Bitcoiners. You can find a list of retailers at bkeychain.com, several of whom support Bitcoin so much they won't even accept fiat currency. And of course, you'll always get the best deal from these retailers. So what are you waiting for? Go to bkeychain.com.
I'm here with Scott Rose, and Scott was the first person I recognized when I arrived at the kickoff party on Friday night, and I did not know how I knew your face, but I knew I knew your face. So I know I've seen that really funny, well-produced video on YouTube where you're kind of telling all these people who don't really give a crap about Bitcoin, and they're just all looking bored, and you're doing all these different activities. But and it's been a while, but I know I looked at your YouTube channel, and you have a bunch of funny tech videos, basically, right?
That's right. That's right. I try to emphasize comedy and tech and try to combine them together if I can. Sometimes I fall flat on my face. Sometimes it works really well. Like with the Bitcoin trilogy, it's this my series is Shit Bitcoin Fanatics Say. Part 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, I didn't even remember this. Part 1, 2, and 3. So if people Google Shit Bitcoin Fanatics Say, they'll find you. And what is your...
They can find me at youtube.com/scotty321, S-C-O-T-T-Y 321. And that's also my Twitter handle as well, scotty321.
Okay. And you have a website or something where you can
direct us to? Yeah, my business is scottworld.com. I'm a FileMaker Pro database programmer.
Uh-huh.
And I'm also working on a Bitcoin product. I'm coming out with the world's first Bitcoin plugin for FileMaker Pro. It probably won't be ready till probably the summer or the fall. We're almost done developing it now. It's going to enable people who use FileMaker Pro databases to run their business. It'll enable them to automatically grab their next receiving address from Coinbase. It requires Coinbase right now because we're using their API. It will enable them to grab their next receiving address from Coinbase and pop it into their invoices, so every invoice that they generate out of FileMaker Pro will have a fresh receiving address and a QR code on their invoice. So people who are currently doing invoicing in FileMaker Pro, they'll be able to accept Bitcoin from their customers.
Wow. So you've just reminded me, I didn't even remember until you started saying that, that I used to use FileMaker Pro to do my invoices back in...
Oh, my God.
I don't know. It would be the 90s, I
guess. Oh, my God. That's amazing. That's amazing. And it's still going strong. You know, it's owned by... Apple owns FileMaker Pro, so it's a huge company.
Right. And I guess at the time I switched because QuickBooks was a little more powerful.
You know, if people are just looking for an accounting package, like typically you don't want to reinvent the wheel by recreating a whole accounting package in FileMaker. But FileMaker is good for custom apps. You know, if your business model doesn't really fit the mold that QuickBooks provides for you, or a lot of people use FileMaker in conjunction with QuickBooks. So they do like really, really advanced invoicing within FileMaker, and then they just send like the grand totals over to QuickBooks so they can do their end of the year reports right out of QuickBooks, things like that. You know, in the early 90s, it was so incredibly basic. And now it's super powerful. They have like an iOS app. I mean, it's totally cross-platform, rapid application development. So if you wanted to write a system for yourself, like to run your business, let's say, you write it once and it immediately works on iOS, Mac, Windows, and the web, all four platforms simultaneously.
Wow. I forgotten about and written it off, and I didn't know it was such a useful product.
Isn't that amazing? It's come a long way. It's probably 1,000 times more useful today than it was 15 years ago.
So is this your own business?
This is my own business. It's just me and one other guy, and that's it. Very small. We service 200 businesses around the country, and so we've written programs that run those companies. And I'm in the process of redoing the website. It'll be brand new next month. And I'm really excited about this Bitcoin integration because I am accepting Bitcoin from my clients and I invoice my clients out of FileMaker. And, you know, for privacy purposes, I always want to have a different receiving address on each invoice. So what I've been doing is logging into Coinbase, generating my next address, copying it, coming back into FileMaker, pasting it in, then running a script to generate the QR code. It's like such a pain, especially if you're like doing a bunch of invoices at once, like 10 invoices at once. And so I'm like, oh my God, I need to create something that automates this process.
Interesting. So it's fine. I'm going to ask you about your workflow. I'm going to tell you mine real quick first and ask about yours. So
yes.
I have the QT client that I will fire up to generate a new address. And sometimes I'll go through and I'll create 10 at a time and just copy and paste them so I don't have to wait for it to fire up even before it, you know, just when it kind of examines, I guess, its state and everything. You got to wait a while.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But how come you use Coinbase? Why not something else?
Well, actually, I actually do use Bitcoin Core software to store my own Bitcoins.
Yeah, I should call it Core now, I guess.
Yeah, or Bitcoin QT. Yeah, both. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. But to answer your question, the reason I'm using Coinbase is I want to hold on to Bitcoins, but I know that a lot of other companies are scared a little bit or might be scared a little bit of the volatility. So a lot of those companies may want to cash out for US dollars or maybe just hold a percentage of their Bitcoin and, you know, the rest in US dollars. So the reason that I'm using Coinbase is A, because they have really great APIs to use. So we could use their APIs. They can generate a random, a real random number to be a private key. You know, like, for example, FileMaker would not be able to generate random keys enough. You know, like these desktop database apps, that they're not truly generating random numbers. They're sort of pseudo random.
I've never even been enough of a power user to want to look at the random number features of these things. So,
oh, right.
So I don't know anything. But
So basically, we're depending on Coinbase because they're generating actually, you know, cryptographically strong random numbers. And also because if our clients use our plugin and they link to Coinbase, they'll be able to immediately cash out for US dollars without any intervention on their part. So they can email a PDF of their invoice to their clients, the client pays it, and then boom, it goes into USD in their checking account.
Okay.
And now eventually we're going to implement BitPay and other payment processors as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't want to just be affiliated with the Coinbase API. We want to give people the choice and the freedom to use whatever service they want. But this is a good first step, basically.
Okay. So you're not using it for your personal invoices just because you like to use Coinbase as a wallet, or do you?
I'm using it because I want to test my plugin right now. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm using Coinbase.
Okay.
And so I'm using it as the first beta tester, basically, of the plugin. But me, most of the time, I'm using Bitcoin Core.
You've got these two separate worlds. Is there a connection? If I go to your website, does it connect to your YouTube stuff, or do you keep it?
It actually does connect. It does connect, and my new website's coming soon is going to connect it even more. Yeah, ever since I was a kid, I was really obsessed with both computers and making people laugh, and so I've sort of tried to combine the two of them through my life, so you'll see that my comedy involves tech, and my tech involves comedy.
Uh-huh.
So actually, my tech doesn't involve comedy too much because people don't like when there's funniness in their software programs.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, I probably started off more as like a shy computer geek myself. And then I got a little bit involved in theater back in high school and college. And then after I graduated from college, I went to UCLA. I got hired to travel around the country with Apple Computer. And so I'm a big Apple fanatic too. And I got to speak on stage around the country for 6 years with Steve Steve Jobs and the executive team at all the conventions nationwide, like all the Macworld conventions. I opened up the first 21 Apple retail stores, and it was very, very cool. But I think one of the greatest things for me was that it enabled me to gain even more confidence in front of the camera or up on stage. And so I just went with it. So now I'm trying to do more video. You'll see more videos from me coming in the future. Just anything to, like, you know, make people laugh. I'm giving a Bitcoin speech here in Austin. Do you live in LA?
Yeah.
Yeah. In Venice?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Very cool. Yeah. I used to live in LA for 20 years.
Right. And you just moved out here when?
I just moved out here about 4 years ago.
Okay.
And so next week, I'm going to be presenting a talk here in Austin about all about Bitcoin.
And who are you speaking to?
I'm speaking to Austin Nerd Night. It's a monthly event. Their website is nerdnight.com, N-I-T-E.com. And they've got different chapters all over the world, actually. I think, I'm not sure. There might actually be one in Los Angeles, too. They're all, like, independently run chapters. And the one in Austin is very, very popular. There's about 350 people that show up every month, self-proclaimed nerds. They don't check your credentials on the way in. You just have to, you know, swear, yes, I am a nerd. And they come in, and every month they have three lectures that are all about a specific topic that month. So this month is going to be the financial topic, and I will be speaking about Bitcoin.
Neat. So I can't just let the Steve Jobs thing go by. I mean, can you give me... Okay.
I'll show you a photo. I'll show you a photo of me and Steve. It's plastered all over my website, too.
You want to email me that so I can put it in the show notes?
I will. It's like my one famous photo. Here it is of me and Steve Jobs at the grand opening of the Palo Alto store in 2001. So that was 14 years ago.
Man, that looks like the photo. Did he just have that look? It looks like I've seen that photo of him standing that way and that look.
I know. Isn't that hilarious? That's his. Yeah, that's like, you know.
You don't even have a new iPhone. What's up?
Yeah, I know, right? Well, it's the 5S, so my 2-year contract isn't up yet.
Yeah, that's what I'm packing to.
Are you 5S too? Yeah.
So, how was he? I mean, did he ever lose his temper in front of you?
You know, a couple of really cool things that I saw was, one thing was he was always there. He was a very, very hands-on CEO. I only spoke with him a few times, but it always made my heart race because I would look down, like in the middle of my speech, and there he was sitting in the front row, front and center, watching me and the other speakers to make sure that, you know, we were living up to the Apple standard. And one time I was speaking at the Apple retail store in Palo Alto, and I was just talking to the audience, you know, because I used to speak at all the grand openings, and then all of a sudden, I didn't even realize he was there yet, and boom, he was standing right there in front of me, as close as you are to me, just about 1 or 2 feet away. And I was so nervous, I like practically like forgot my lines right in that moment. I'm like, oh my God, I'm standing nose to nose practically with Steve Jobs. But, you know, if you went up to him and chatted with him, he was very cordial, a lot quieter than you would think. And one time I did see him actually fire somebody. I actually didn't personally see him do the firing, but he was sitting in the audience when another one of our speakers made a mistake on stage. And mistakes are okay, you know, as long as you correct the mistake and move on. But this guy stopped his speech. It was probably in front of about 1,000 people or so. Stopped his speech, called attention to his mistake, then started banging his head with his hand and saying, oh, I'm so stupid, 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 stupid. He started calling himself stupid on stage, saying, you guys, that was such a terrible mistake. And his mistake was only that he called an LCD monitor a CRT monitor on accident. And all he had to do was say, oh, I'm sorry, you guys, I meant LCD. But Steve Jobs did not like that because it was not professional. So Steve Jobs went backstage, talked to some people and said, look, we can't have that sort of presenter on stage. And that was it. He was not able to speak anymore.
Would you get discounts and such?
We would not get discounts.
No. Okay.
No. But we got cool Apple T-shirts, though.
All right, well, that's something.
I used to collect Apple T-shirts, so it was a huge deal for me to get those free Apple T-shirts.
So right now, the YouTube thing, is that, is that monetized in any way, or is it just for fun?
The YouTube, not really. You know, the YouTube thing's mostly for fun. I do put my QR code, one of my Bitcoin QR codes at the end of the videos, and the Bitcoin community is so incredibly generous that they have given us some donations. I believe that with the Shit Bitcoin Fanatics Say series, I think that the community has donated a little bit under one Bitcoin to those videos.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I actually haven't checked in a while the exact number, but I think it's just shy of one Bitcoin, I believe.
Well, that's what's nice about the public blockchain. Anyone can go look for themselves and see how much you've made.
Yeah, exactly.
So I guess what would be interesting is when you got paid. I guess someone could look and see when you got paid, see if any of those coins came in at above 1,000 or...
Exactly. Or, I did those videos about a year ago, so they were definitely worth more at the time. And it's just, that's just the most amazing thing, I think, about this technology. I mean, maybe not the most amazing things, but one of the top 20 amazing things about Bitcoin technology is how cool is it that any of us from anywhere in the world can donate freely to anybody that we want instantly anywhere in the world for any reason that we want to give them the money. We don't even need to reveal our identity or anything. I think that's just so cool.
It is very neat. And with Tipper Coin, the people don't even have to have, or not, keep saying Tipper Coin, the old one. There's been so many tipping coins.
Oh, yeah.
Change Tip. I kept doing that yesterday when I was talking to Bruce Fenton.
Oh.
Calling it Tipper Coin by mistake. Change Tip,
yeah.
But you remember Tipper Coin?
I actually don't remember. I must have gotten involved after that.
Or maybe it was just off your radar. But there was even one before that, too, that that worked with like Twitter, kind of the same way Change Tip works. But
Oh, you're right, because with Change Tip, they don't even need to have a wallet at all, and you could tip them.
Right. These other ones work the same way. I think, you'd get a thing, and then you'd have to sign up to kind of get it going. But
I think that's great. I think Change Tip is brilliant. Change Tip really got my girlfriend excited. Oh, we did a video with my girlfriend. My most recent YouTube video is with my girlfriend, Carrie. She was a pedicab at South by Southwest, a pedicab driver, and she was accepting Bitcoin. And so she was explaining to the general public every day about Bitcoin. And then she discovered ChangeTip and started telling everyone about ChangeTip. And she was just so impressed, just like I am, about how easy it is to tip. I mean, we're living in like a brave new world right now with all this.
It's crazy. No one could even imagine it a few years ago.
Totally.
I see my roommate walking by. How you doing? Did you get some sleep? Yeah. Everything okay?
Are you just waking up? It's 2 p.m. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I've already heard some other stories about last night from other people, but he came in when I was waking up this morning.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
He must love Austin.
Well, he's, he was one of the presenters here. But what was interesting is, he said there's, for the kind of higher level guys here, they go to all the conferences, and a lot of it's just networking after the conference, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
So, he was hanging out with some other the kind of, I guess, higher level. Like most of the people, I mean, I'm getting to talk to higher level people, but it seems like a lot of the people I've been hanging out with are more, people who are a little lower level, I guess, as far as, but you never know. Any of these people, I guess, could start a game-changing Bitcoin business and be on the top of the world in a year or something.
Oh, my God, it's so true. It's so true. I was just telling John from Bitcoins and Gravy about that. In 1999, I was at this convention called Internet World. The Internet had not truly taken off to the masses yet, although it was building up steam. And there were people running around handing out Google postcards.
Oh.
And everyone's like, what is Google? What is this? And for all we know, maybe one of those guys running around was, Sergi or Larry.
Well, just think even, Sean Wilkins seems like a kind of a, is it Wilkins or Wilkinson? Storage guy.
He did a great speech yesterday. He kicked off the whole conference.
Oh, yeah, I did see his speech, right. Everything's blurring together. I think he was just one of the hackers in the back room last year, and now he seems like one of the rocks. As I was telling him, he seems kind of like a Bitcoin rock star.
Oh,
now.
My God, I know, right? Isn't that amazing? I mean, that's another cool thing about this industry is that it's so young, it's so new, that you could be standing next to the very next rock star in this industry.
Really,
we're communicating with the young generation, and they're excited to make change for the future.
Boy, and all these people could be, form heads of Google-sized companies in
absolutely,
5 to 10 years, too.
Absolutely. Oh, here she is herself, Carrie Scott, pedicab driver from South by Southwest, YouTube star.
Hello.
Hi.
Carrie, do you have anything to say about the Texas Bitcoin Conference?
Oh, I am enjoying it immensely. I have to very carefully schedule bathroom breaks in order not to miss anything.
That's true. There's no breaks.
I'm quite fanatical about Bitcoin and wanting to contribute to the space and the growth and usage. And I've essentially cleared my schedule professionally as of the beginning of the year. And so, yeah, I am looking for opportunities and finding where the need is that I can fill.
Okay, well, in case any employers in Austin are listening to this podcast, what skills do you bring to the table?
Yeah, I have a background in social science and teaching. So I think I could really contribute to kind of bridging the gap between the experts, the technical experts, versus the common user and what the needs of the common user may be, and kind of connecting some of those dots.
I think a lot of companies would have a need for someone like that.
I think so.
We've already talked about Scott's website and stuff. Should they just contact him, or do you have a Twitter account or something?
Yeah, I do use Twitter. My Twitter handle is at StarCarrie, StarCarrie 9.
Well, cool. You guys make a handsome couple.
Thank you.
Rob, it is such a great pleasure to be on your podcast, and I'm so excited to meet you this weekend.
We never know what it's going to make the cut, but...
don't speak too soon.
Oh, yeah, don't speak too soon. Yeah. Only if you keep in the good parts am I pleased to meet you.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to probably be able to have an episode every day for a month with all the people I've spoken to. So this will be really interesting.
Take a month off.
Well, and it's funny, because usually I'm every 2 weeks, so it's hard. And here comes the developer from the Mycelium Wallet, who I was speaking to yesterday.
Wallet.
Hey, do you got a second? Or heading to the restroom? I'll see you on the way back. Okay.
Rob, thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, guys. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
It's great being a fellow Los Angelian.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to episode 16 of The Bitcoin Game. Yet another episode based on my trip to the Texas Bitcoin Conference. Stay tuned to upcoming episodes of The Bitcoin Game for even more interviews from this conference. And I'm going to break from the script right now. Take a sip of coffee here. I'm recording this early in the morning. Living in the city, it's the only time it's relatively quiet. Otherwise, we've got cars and stuff going by all day. Wanted to just let my audience know that just a couple days ago on Saturday, there was a big Bitcoin event, basically a Bitcoin conference here in Los Angeles, the first one. And I almost overlooked it because it wasn't really marketed as Bitcoin conference. It was called the State of Digital Money. And for some reason, I wasn't paying enough attention to it, even though it was listed on our meetup group page and all that stuff. And the organizer, Alan, called me up a couple weeks before the event. And I had assumed he would just wanted me to come and cover this event. And I was shocked when he asked me if I would MC the event. I was like, well, I was just at my first Bitcoin conference in Texas, and now you're asking me to MC a Bitcoin conference here in LA with a lot of pretty prestigious people. The person who I was kind of most excited to be in the presence of was Jeff Garzik. So at first I said no. I was really busy with work, and I just thought, boy, being gone a full day was going to be really difficult for me. And I guess I felt nervous, didn't know if I felt qualified, and... Then I let it sink in a little bit more. I started reviewing some of my recordings from the Texas conference, especially from the actual speakers and panels, and listening to the introductions. And I realized, hey, I could do this. So I got back to Alan and said, yes, I will do this. And I did it. And it was really good. I attended the Texas conference because I got to see how people did introductions, got to see, you know, what I liked, what I didn't like, and tried to learn from that so I could do a good job. Anyway, back to the script. You can find a listing of all the episodes of The Bitcoin Game by going to thebitcoingame.com. Please let me know you listened by following or tweeting to The BTC Game on Twitter, or by commenting on this episode's page on letstalkbitcoin.com. See you next time. We'll be right back.
know? Let's strive, fellow. Smart diagnostics finding something? What's going wrong? There seems to be some disk error. Oh, no. When did I last back up? I don't know. I know. I've lost money. No.